You're listening to The Greenest Metaphor.
Esther was like a kind of wood nymph or sprite, you know. She would flit through the autumnal meadows, backlit with the glowing light of the sun or those huge lights they use when they make movies. I forget what you call them. Anyway, she was just beautiful. Porky Samuelson, the picture director, used to say that Esther was like a metaphor in bloom. No kidding. Nope. No kidding.
It's not easy being green. Having to spend its day in the color of the leaves. When it could be nicer being red, yellow or gold, or something much more colorful like that. Like that. It's not easy being green. You seem to blend in with so many ordinary everyday things. People tend to pass you by because you're not standing out like sparkles in the water.
Where the vegetables are green and you can pee into the stream.
Right on, right
yes,
on.
We're back from the shadows again. Howdy, everybody. I'm the Whispering Squad.
And I'm the Lonesome Bee Tick.
And I'm Artie Choke. And we're just a joke.
And don't be afraid, little people, because we're just Holy Graham.
Great.
Yeah, but what about you, partner? What you doing today?
Can't be much, Lonesome. Nobody's working.
Nobody except us, and I'm getting tired of standing here with these geeks a-gawking at me.
Now you keep it sweet, Pete.
Listen here, Leafhead, I'm gonna
Now, boys, fighting's out of style, yeah. And fun's where the fair's at. In the future, that is.
You can bet your roots towards it's tons of fun.
And technical stimulation.
That's what I need.
And there's lots more of me where I come from.
In government-inflicted simulation.
The future can't wait. No place to hide.
So climb on aboard.
We're going inside.
We're going back to the shadows again. Out where an Indian's your friend.
Going down.
Where the vegetables are green. And you can pee right into the stream. And that's important. We're back from the shadows again.
This could probably help us solve the solid waste disposal problem. Because
what
cow
solid
can...
waste is... By the way, I just want to ask all you members, Sergeant Lupetsky here of the Environment Army, what waste disposal problem? I don't have any waste disposal problem.
You obviously don't get the Sunday paper.
I don't get wasted anymore, that's why. I used to get so wasted.
Well, I get wasted on Sunday and read the paper.
Right, and then drink it the next day, you read.
The entire rest of the week, if the weather is cold,
right.
I crush up small sections of the newspaper.
Yeah.
Put them in my fireplace, which is about a foot deep and a foot wide. Very small fireplace.
You know, now you don't have to have the cold weather now. No, you can just spray the detergent on the paper, and then the cold comes and the body heat from the paper goes and it is freezing, it falls.
Look, here comes a flight of frozen blackbirds.
In 1971, this iconic ad debuted on American television. An indigenous American figure, played by Iron Eyes Cody, paddles a canoe in pristine water. He pulls ashore on a garbage-strewn beach, walks up a hill, and then onto the shoulder of a busy highway.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country.
As he looks on, someone chucks a bag of trash from a passing car.
And some people don't.
As the garbage scatters across his feet, he turns his face to the camera, and we see a single tear drop from his eye.
Hey! Danger! Where's the fire?
In your eyes, Lieutenant Bradshaw.
People start pollution. People can stop it. Write for Pollution Booklet, Box 1771, Radio City Station, New York.
That public service announcement, or PSA, was from the nonprofit organization called Keep America Beautiful. It became known as the Crying Indian ad.
How? Wow. I tell you how. Ancient Indian legends say 30 million moons ago, great God Kachu lived far to north in frigid New York.
Oh, come on.
One day, eat bad street dog.
I've done that.
Throw up on world below. Oh. Create rich soil.
Hammer Indian
in
nonsense.
Which
this,
maybe this
knob's the sacrifice.
Or the ironized Cody ad. Its message is simple. America used to be beautiful and clean. So when you litter, you're betraying that pristine heritage.
Yeah, the ironized Cody ad is a great example of environmental communication that has both good elements to it and then unintended consequences.
Lucy Atkinson is an associate professor of advertising and public relations at the University of Texas.
I study environmental communication with a focus on persuasion, which can sound bad, but it's really about trying to get audiences to understand environmental issues and to appreciate the severity of what we're facing in terms of climate change. You know, the obvious are those ads that you see in magazines or television, if you don't skip through ads, but in less obvious ways as well. Certainly the way politicians talk, but even conversations that you might have with friends or strangers, you know, the way that we talk about things, the words that we use, the approach that we take to talking to people, it can be persuasive. Even informative news stories can have a persuasive angle to them.
To help sift through that mountain of information and persuasion, I went over that ironized Cody ad with Professor Atkinson. Millions of people have seen the ad, both when it came out 50 years ago and more recently online, but it has issues, not the least of which is that late in ironized Cody's life, his half-sister revealed that he was not, as he claimed, Native American, but an Italian-American born Oscar de Corti.
God bless Vespucci land.
Oh, by the way, Domini, you're all Catholics now. God bless you.
Come on, and Father, nobody in their right mind would live in this stinking desert.
Come on, Cisco.
The other problem has to do with framing. And the ironized Cody ad has a very specific frame.
In the 1970s, litter was a big issue. And it's framing the issue as something that the individual needs to fix, to not litter, to not throw things out the car window. It's your job to fix it.
So why might the nonprofit Keep America Beautiful want to frame the issue this way? People start pollution, people can stop it? Well, it may have to do with the fact that the organization's founders included aluminum can manufacturers, later joined by the Dixie Cup Corporation, Coca-Cola, and cigarette companies, who started the organization in the 1950s. And their ads and PSAs made it clear the responsibility for the cans and cigarette butts littered all over the place has nothing to do with the materials used in packaging or any laws regulating where you can smoke or who bears the ultimate cost of cleaning up the mess. No, it's not a problem for the people who sell the cans and cigarettes. It's your problem.
Keeping America Beautiful is a family affair.
This is one of Keep America Beautiful's earlier ads, featuring their 1960s slogan, "Every litter bit hurts."
Keep your highways handsome. Carry a litter bag in the car and use it. Keep your streets neat by using a litter basket. Keep your parks pretty. Remember, be on guard against unconscious littering.
I still can't figure out what unconscious littering is. But the issue of framing is different from simply greenwashing when a company tries to seem more environmentally responsible than it actually is. Framing is an attempt to change the way we think about an issue, what the problem really is, who's responsible for it, and which solutions may be entailed.
Keep America Beautiful. Make it a family project.
At Lope Freeway, 1 mile.
Clean up our media. Get a hair lift.
At Lope Freeway, 1/2 mile.
Chili Avenue, Old
Pass. See what they got in this car.
And the framing issue is alive and well in messages around climate change.
people will frame climate change as an economic issue. Either that if we have to make changes to industry, to the way that we do business, either we're going to lose jobs, or the other side of it is that we are going to gain jobs in new industry. There's a health frame. We can talk about how climate change is damaging our health.
And now, a pause in the busy day's activity. As the doctor leaves his little rectumery, walks out the marble path covered with aggies and cat's eyes from his youth, down the long path of life, past the elm grove of superstition, and toward the true way. Yes, it's Dr. Whiplash. He's come again to the font of perpetual resurrection to answer some of your questions.
Come in, Doctor.
Dave, what's the first question?
Well, I have a letter here from a gentleman in Flotsam's Mistake, New Jersey. And actually, he's been kind enough to send this letter in on a tape cassette for you, Doctor, so we'll hear his voice and you can use his voice to help you analyze the problem.
It's a novel idea. Leave it to the Japs.
Dr. Whiplash, I am a Japanese businessman. Why have I written before? So I still suffering from the same complaint. I only suffer in the office during the day. At night, I eat out and feel better. And although I can't sleep, it's because of a part of my noise. What should I do? Hideo Gump.
Dear Hideo, your symptoms are shared by people other than your race. To wit, many executives complain to me as suffering from flushing, blushing, running of the mouth, high stool, seat cramps, delayed borgorygmus, and shortness of pants. They also, like you, feel relieved of these symptoms away from the orifice. Can anything be done? Yes. And it should be done now. They, and you, Hideo, are suffering from farmer's lung, usually confined to barns and sponge warehouses. It is attributable to a hybrid fungus, which lodges in the massive air conditioning systems that supply oxygen of sorts to the big buildings that your daddy works in. Although the same bug can be found in home furnaces, it's often rendered ineffectual due to the fact that poor people can't afford air conditioning and are forced to run their furnaces to heat their homes during the summer. This fries the fungus. We doctor people use the word Microsporifera funi in referring to this little pest, and literally it can be translated as funny spores, long known as the cause of Theodore's disease, running sores in athlete's feet. Recently, this microscopic troublemaker has also been blamed in the nasty disease labeled Hartman's palsy, formerly Strassman syndrome, the only cure for which is death. I'll answer any questions, dear friends. Just write me if you still have the strength. Until next week, this is Dr. Whiplash. I'm out for lunch.
We can frame something as an issue that's going to affect, you know, generations down the line. And so we need to take their interests into account, or we could frame it as something that's actually affecting people right now. And there's more urgency to it.
We got to bring China and Russia and Brazil and Pakistan and India and every major country on earth into the fight against climate change. That instead of spending $1.8 trillion a year collectively on weapons of destruction designed to kill each other, maybe we pool our resources and fight our common enemy, which is climate change.
So, David,
an ecology conference of concerned newspaper college editors. And the funny thing about it was that we stood
in a crowded hall with people pouring by, and people were saying, there will be a demonstration of garbage on the third floor at 5:30 if you want to come. And they were handing out leaflets, people were crumpling them up and throwing them on
the ground floor.
So you stood, like, on top of three or four people, and he said, isn't overpopulation, I think that's the major, that's a major part of, major problem is
overpopulation. Hey, what the,
I think garbage myself. If we can get rid of all the garbage.
You're listening to the Fireside Theater.
You hold this for me, Tiny.
Like this. Have you ever seen the way they package these little ecology announcements?
If you'd like to call
it, sheets of plastic.
If you'd like to call in and give us your address, we'll send you all the garbage we've got, right? All the methane gas, too, comes in a big
Where are you going, gentlemen, after the...
To paradise,
to
Paul.
To hell, Paul. Oh,
some disagreement among the group here.
It must be the politics.
Let's work it out.
Paradise, Phil.
I say hell, Phil.
I say paradise to that, Phil.
Well, to hell...
You call this hell... You haven't seen hell. I've been through hell. I went through hell with the big man.
Well, okay, buddy. Tell me about this paradise. Tell me about it, huh?
Listen.
What's so good about this paradise?
Paradise is that feeling you get.
This is New York. This is
feeling you get in New
glamour,
York,
baby. You gotta be rough.
You
gotta
get
be
New
tough.
York after eating at the cold.
You gotta get up there on the great white
restaurant.
Way.
Wars play a big role in our culture. So there have been many major wars in the history of the Western world. And so war is something that is common ground to most of us. We all know about wars. They play a big role in how we honor the past and how we criticize certain regimes. They play a big role in media, in film, popular culture, video games. So wars themselves in our minds are kind of omnipresent. And that's the first step. The second step is that the concept of a war has a pretty clear conceptual structure. So what do I mean by that? I mean that people kind of know what a war entails. There's two sides. There's a conflict between them. Each side is trying to destroy the other. So there's winners and losers. Wars involve a mobilization of an entire force or unit against another. And so wars are common. They're a universal aspect of our cultural experience, and people know about them. The third part about it is that war has a very strong emotional connotation. So wars convey a sense of urgency and risk. They're scary. And so whenever politicians or journalists or pundits are trying to get attention to an issue, it helps to use language that activates strong emotions, and wars do that.
And if you want a good war metaphor, you need a good war, or what's been called the last good war.
Under a total security blackout, the 1st Canadian Corps moves from Italy to the Western Theater of Operations.
You know, because it's an interesting phenomenon, both during and before the pandemic, that there's been this resurgence of World War II books and films. Like our Netflix, you know, is filled with these reboots, and there's a whole shelf in every bookstore of World War II books. So people remain very engaged with this story.
Are you a fan of the Second World War?
Huh?
What?
God, yeah. That was a great little war. Were you? You heard about the Second World War?
Yeah, I fought in the army, you know, in the Second World War.
Phil and I met in the Second World War. Phil Watanabe
I was fighting also, you know. Right?
Were you?
I fought in Europe. I fought in Sicily. I retreated before the Americans, right? Not from both sides, of course.
Yeah.
I was Swiss. I couldn't take any sides, you know.
Well, yeah, but now with the gay lib and everything, you can really stand up for your rights.
I can lie down for my rights now.
Well, anything you want.
Either way.
On your
sides,
sure.
Right.
We hope you've enjoyed this educational discussion between three recent veterans of the American Fighting Forces. They'll be back again on Answers to Questions tomorrow.
Ow!
Hey, did you hit me?
You remember Iwo Jima? Ow! Remember the Coral Sea?
Yeah.
About France? This is for Italy. And this one's for Germany. This is for Denmark, you swine. This one's for Miami. Chicago. Cincinnati. Grand Funk Railroad.
The frogs often fight before large numbers of spectators, drawn to the battlefield by the screams of the frogs, which in battle resemble the cries of a baby. Frog fights by biting and hopping. The combatants begin simultaneously obeying some mysterious signal. Suddenly, there is a flurry of fog legs. Jaws gnash audibly as they rip and tear at each other. When the battle ends, the survivors often carry their dead and wounded off.
In the early 1940s, frogs marched on each other in two different areas of what is now Malaysia. In 1948, frogs again went to war in one state. In May of 1969, frogs attacked one another north of Kuala Lumpur. 12 days later, race riots broke out in the capital.
I'll race you for a riot!
In November 1970, more than 3,000 frogs of four different varieties fought a six-hour battle. Soon after, the country was struck by raging floods, which killed at least 70 persons.
All right, you frogs, get out of the bar. There'll be no fighting here again.
Oh, sacre bleu, je n'ai pas rien à boire. Salut, je vais la foutre.
Watch out for the
door!
We got some mail over there, Froggy.
Yeah.
Come back from the war.
It's time for mail.
Touch your magic wanger, Froggy. Boing!
But my feeling is all of these people out there who are watching these shows and reading these books, you know, when they turn off the TV at night or they close the book, the question in their head is, what would I have done if I had lived then and there? And the argument I'm making is, there's no great mystery in terms of answering that question, because we are here again. The future of our children is cast into doubt. A civilizational threat is at our doorstep. And so the answer to that question is whatever we are each ready to do now.
What can you do to help win the war? Do you help with civil defense work? Do you pay your taxes on time and in full? Are you ready to cooperate quietly with the FBI in apprehending suspicious persons? Are you a victory gardener? Do you avoid unnecessary expenditures? Do you cheerfully observe all rationing regulations? Do you avoid panic buying and refuse to hoard? Do you use and save cooking fats and other needed materials?
My mother used to save chicken fat and lard and stuff like that. We used to go down to Brooders and turn it in. That was a guy's name, Brooder, right? Let's take the fat down to Brooders and get our rationing stamps.
But I also want to double back to your earlier point about, you know, this question about hope and despair. Because the other point where I pull some solace from this World War II story, like now, where we live in this ambiguous time, right? We do not know if we will do what we need to do in time to win this fight. It is fascinating to me that in World War II, Canada was a population of a little over 11 million people. From that, over a million Canadians enlisted. Now that is a remarkable figure. But what they didn't know, Claude, is whether or not they would win.
Writer Rebecca Solnit. Hope locates itself in the premises that we don't know what will happen, and that in the spaciousness of uncertainty is room to act.
We forget, right? Because we know how the story ended, but they did not. And there were a number of years in the early part of the war where the outcome was far from certain, and yet they did what they had to do anyway. And they, in the process, surprised themselves by what they were capable of accomplishing, both on the battlefront and, more to the point of my book, on the home front. And that's the spirit we just need to go with today.
It is a strange war that doesn't do things to languages. And one of the interesting byproducts of World War II is a series of expressions that appeared in England. For instance, Americans will undoubtedly soon be endeavoring to fit scran, choker, and wizard into their own speech. In World War II, a rookie is no longer a rookie. He is an irk. Nothing is ever bad.
He is irked.
He is irked, right.
That's all that's left of him after the bombshell. All I found was his irk, which is the neck without an end.
With a little metal on it.
A little metal on it, right?
It's a knife without a handle.
Knife without a handle and his neck without an end. And a nerk.
A knife without
and narcs are guys who go around doing that now, and it's legal.
That's right. Nothing is ever bad. It is ropey.
Ropey?
Right. And a ropey job is likely as not to be a blonde who proved uncollaborative.
Uncollaborative?
Uncollaborative.
You know what collaboration means? I keep assuming a lot of people know these words. Yes. That's what you get your hair shaved for being a collaborator, baby. That means you and the...
This was 1942.
The schnacker.
Sophia Loren got lots of mileage out of making movies like that.
Anything that turns out badly.
Collaboration.
Yeah.
Vittorio De Sica.
You know, I've noticed.
Sophia Loren. Lorenzo Bicycle.
Right. Right.
I've noticed that you hold your breath when you smoke a normal cigarette. Anything that turns out badly, whether
how
it be.
How do you know this is a normal cigarette?
It's
that's a normal cigarette.
How do you like the taste, Phil?
It's wonderful. And it doesn't upset my stomach.
A soldier is never fed up to the teeth. He's browned off or brassed off. When army things are under control, they're buttoned up. Otherwise, they may be cheesed.
Cheesed?
That's where hard cheese comes from. Hard cheese, Terry Thomas' expression.
Right, right. That man's, there's a cryogenics concern in Glendale now called Solid Jackson.
Really?
That's right, man.
Sleeping is dizzy.
Is that true?
That's true.
Sleeping?
Right next to that big pond of fish.
Listen.
Limping in the moonlight.
Okay.
Oh, I see.
I see. No, DC.
The two stories sort of tend to corroborate each other.
They collaborate.
Or collaborate.
Right. Right. The schnacker told them to.
Oh, you said it.
No, I didn't. Oh, I said the schnacker.
Anyway, wait a minute. I don't think it's schnacker. I think we got another word for this. Yeah, the word this time is, let's see, stupor. That was
no,
last
not the
week.
Stupor.
No, that was 2 weeks ago.
Stupor is what you get in if you're stupid.
Yeah, the Agnew.
The Agnew?
The Agnew.
The Agnew is the name?
Oh, yeah.
He's
yeah.
number two.
So don't mention the little,
the little Agnew.
Now, here's some language that'll probably tickle the fancy of a lot of girls out there in the audience. This is the language that came from the lips of the pert young wrens, as the blue uniform girls of the Women's Royal Naval Service are called. You probably remember that, Annalie. When a wren
they
says...
They cut their hair to make wigs for enemy agents. You know.
That's right. When a wren says, I mustn't be adrift too late, or else the jaunty will put me in the rattle and the bloke will give me a bottle. She means... I must return from leave on time, or the master-at-arms will bring me before the commanding officer for a lecture.
For electron, actually. Right.
When Jenny the Wren is fed up with the world, she is chukka. And when she grumbles, she's guilty of dripping. Sleeping is zizzing, whether it's on the job or in the hammock.
Are you zizzing or dripping, dear?
To the wren, her sailor boyfriend is a killick, or if he's a soldier, he's a pongo.
Pongo! Oh, you're dripping again.
Crushers are male or female petty officers.
Oh, you're zizzing. Oh, well, take a look at this.
This chicken last week. I was cheesed off, so I jumped at her.
When a sweetheart or companion in the Navy is an oppo.
Oh, yeah.
An oppo.
Pongo, oppo, oppo.
When a wren, killick, or battle ship is dressed up, she, he, or it is tiddly. And when a sailor goes on leave, he goes up the line. I'm going up the line with a dripping broad. Get me some tiddly. A parachute is not a parachute, but a brolly. The rear gunner's turret is the dustbin. A coastal command plane is a kipper kite. The bomb-dropping mechanism is a Mickey Mouse.
No, and Mickey Moused.
Oh, Mickey missed. And the automatic pilot is George.
Hi, George.
A fighter pilot climbs into the pulpit of his plane and pulls the greenhouse.
Does
cockpit.
What? Does what? Climbs,
he climbs into the pulpit of his plane.
Ready for the flash, Pastor?
Yeah, all right. And pulls the greenhouse cockpit cover over him when he's off to hunt a solid lump of blitz. He's off
dripping
to hunt
blitz,
a solid lump of blitz.
The copper kite gave me some dripping blitz.
Which is enemy
that's
formation.
That's not right, is it?
Waiting in the air for a Junker Schmidt to appear, he snakes about or plays pussy in the clouds. Then he screams downhill and sends the German into the drink with a quickie. Can you believe it?
You couldn't put those words together on the air without being lewd.
Each month, a
so
few outstanding pilots polish their buttons and go to Buckingham Palace to collect a gong. No flyer spares his contempt for the penguins, the non-flying administrative officers in the RAF. Everything is a type in the RAF, and all flyers take views. If a girl has good lines, she may be a pucker type. But a Heinkel pilot who shoots too soon or runs for home is definitely a poor type or just a pleep. A pilot takes an outside view of Berlin when the air over the Nazi capital is full of flak and crickets, German night fighters, but when a weekend with no operations and a Saturday night party has been laid on, the view is definitely wizard.
Wizard. And it takes a wizard.
Hodgins. Hodgins. The wizard. Hodgins.
She's a pucker type.
Yeah, right.
Good-o.
Pongo. Pongo. Zzz. Drip, 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 drip. What a war. What a war.
Hodgins. Hodgins.
Far out.
Far out. Far out.
And of course, the issue is beyond the climate emergency, even though it is the most urgent, because the way we live is unsustainable. There's all kinds of related issues in the just transition and all of that. But I think what you're saying is that we need to tackle all of those in parallel, or at least in some kind of coordinated way, and change the way we live. And that takes a massive effort that we have done, but essentially the entire country, every aspect of it has to be mobilized, mm-hmm. essentially on the same page.
And we can. Like, this too is an interesting example out of the war, that, as you say, the book is saying we need to rebalance a whole bunch of things about how we live. To me, this is part of the appeal of the Green New Deal today, that it isn't just about electrifying and decarbonizing our economy. It's about tackling inequality. It's about changing the balance of what do we pay for on our own and what do we do together collectively. And there too, you see this echo in the World War II story, because in the early part of the war, the recruitment numbers weren't what they needed to be. And the propaganda, from government at the time was very unsubtle, shall we say. And it was, get out, go get Hitler. And that worked to a point, but only to a point. And what the authorities realized as of 1942 is they had to take a different tact. And key to true society-wide mobilization and to hitting those recruitment numbers that they wanted to hit to avoid mandatory conscription was... they couldn't just tell people, oh, go fight, across two oceans for some abstract idea. They had to engage Canadians in a conversation about what kind of society they would come back to. Hmm. And they had to make a pledge and a promise that the society they would come back to would look different and more just than the one they were leaving behind. That's when the mobilization happens. That's when you hit the recruitment numbers. And that's, I think, has its echo in the appeal of the Green New Deal today.
We are flying toward a big American city in the year 2000 AD. The wings of our Zeppelin tilt, and below we see green squares and circles and triangles that look like parks.
Look at those narcs!
Golden threads of roads tie the patches of green together. In the distance, pink and white and yellow skyscrapers sparkle. The air looks as if someone had washed it.
Where's the soap?
Where is the smoke?
We ask our guide, Mr. Fuller, and Mr. Fuller laughs.
There isn't any smoke to speak of. Cities got rid of smoke years ago. Few people burn coal for heat anymore. Coal is used for other purposes.
Our Zeppelin lands smoothly on an enormous landing field.
We'll drive downtown. We could take a helicopter, but you'll see more by road. Now, this road over here, this pink one, that's an expressway. When we started to make our cities more comfortable to live in, we built expressways all through it. On the expressways, you can go quickly from the edge of the city to the center, or from one side to the other. And since one expressway never runs directly into another one, we have few traffic accidents.
Gee, what a lot of narcs!
Well, we do have a lot of parks, but those aren't parks. Those are neighborhoods. Look, you can see the houses.
Hey, what is a neighborhood?
It's a group of about 2,000 poor people. These people have their own grade school, churches, all-night drug abusement center, and play fields. Several neighborhoods go together as a clang or community. The community has a high school, a community center, a hospital, and a health bund.
Well, I'm glad I asked.
Listen, where's the free clinic?
Well, you may ask, but we took that away with the old gridiron streets. You see, those lead to dead end and weird children. Now the children can ride themselves safely on neighborhood streets. Now, as we approach the business district, you'll notice those tall apartment buildings over there.
Look at that.
Now, 50 years ago, this was one of the worst slums in the United States. 7,000 people that were falling down were crowded into old houses. Now, 24,000 people live there comfortably. The extra space comes from turning the old streets upside down into parks and laying the tall apartment buildings on their sides.
Look out for that robot! Oh, where are the whorehouses?
Well, many of the warehouses live here along the river. City factories aren't allowed to be smoky and noisy, so the warehouses are out in the country.
As we drive slowly through the streets of the Garden City, we wish we could stay in the year 2000 AD, but Mr. Fuller says we must come back.
Yeah, come back.
Now you have seen how cities can look and will look.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Uncle
yes,
David.
America is a land of towns and cities. We should make it a land of beautiful towns and cities. They should be good places for people to play and to live and to work.
Why is he changing
work,
his voice?
Work, work.
They assume that at the outbreak of World War II, everyone was on board, ready to rally, you know, to the cause. That's not true. It took work. It took leadership to get the public on board. And there was mobilization of arts and culture as a key piece of that.
And now, back to Channel One's The Late Late Show, Babes in Khaki.
Oh, bite and kill!
You bet you will!
We got orders to surround these little gooks.
That'll be easy, Lieutenant. There's millions of them on all three sides of us.
That means we got those little gooks right where we want them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and tonight's the planting moon. Several one of them is going to be out waiting in the paddies.
Me too.
Hey, this sounds like a perfect setup. What are we going to do, Lieutenant?
What are we going to do, Lieutenant?
What are we going to do, Lieutenant?
All right. Men, we're going to deploy at 0800.
Check.
Recon all LOM sectors.
Check.
Bring up the 455s.
Pull.
Locate our fire perimeters.
Bonk.
Make a clean sweep. Flush out the enemy and...
What's that, sir?
Sir, Lieutenant, excuse me, sir. What are we gonna do, man?
Yeah, after we flush them out.
We're gonna lock and load, Private. And we're gonna go out there and...
Hey, man, what are we gonna do, man?
What are we doing? We lock and load, then.
Hey, Lieutenant,
what are we gonna do?
Take it easy.
So, you know, as in World War One, artists and painters were sent to the front to document the fight. Filmmakers pumped out all kinds of films. Artists produced these ubiquitous posters that rallied and recruited the public. Musicians produced a popular soundtrack for the fight. Hollywood stars were marshaled to sell victory bonds in the United States. So at many levels, there was a role for the arts. In the book, I talk both about the role of the media. It's interesting. It was really a bit of fortuitous timing that only 3 years before the war, the CBC was created. Only a radio service at the time, but you had the reach there of almost all Canadians. And of course, the voice of the CBC in the war was this guy, Lorne Green, who, now I don't want to assume your age and my age.
If you're
my parents' age, you associate Lorne Green with Pa Cartwright in Bonanza.
High Pockets! High Pockets, consarn it! Where are you, High Pockets?
I'm over here by the grave, consarn it. Stop shouting, Hunk.
What you doing out here by yourself, boy?
Oh, I'm just moping around, Hunk. Dad wouldn't let me go next door to watch the alfalfa.
Criminantless, boy. That wanderlust of yours is going to be the end of us.
Hey, Hunk!
Get off my back, Bronco! I'm warning you! Stop riding me!
Hey. Leave him alone, Bronco. We just talking.
I didn't mean nothing by it. I'm just fooling.
Where you been, Bronco?
Into town. I picked up the mail and the new school marm.
I'll kill you, Bronco! I swear I'll kill you!
Leave kid alone, Bronco. You know how it feels about her.
Permanently, Hunk. Man can't have no fun around here.
I'll kill you, Bronco! I swear I will!
Hush now, boys. Hush now. Here comes Pop.
Howdy, boys.
Hello, sir.
Hi, Pa.
Howdy, Dad.
I'll kill you!
I want you to come away from the grave, wash your hands and faces, and get on down to the house lickety-split.
Your pappy's got a surprise for you, boys. I want you to come and meet your new mother, the school mom.
Bum bumbity 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 bum garbanza. Bumbity 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 bum bum bum. Bumbity 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 bum garbanza.
Garbanza, brought to you by the makers of Loco Coco.
Things go better with Loco Coco. Things go better with Coke.
And by Eddie Chrysler Motors, makers of
the Avenger.
By day, a snappy pickup. In the afternoon, a family convertible.
Beep, 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 beep.
By night, a deadly weapon. The Avenger.
Viva USA, through your turret bay. Your anti-Chrysler car will hold them off.
Sure.
And if you're a child of the 70s like me, you associate him with the original Battlestar Galactica. But in the war, he was affectionately known to Canadians as the voice of doom. You know, every night people gather around the radio for the latest.
You know, my friend Peter Bergman promulgated the first law of radio. It is as follows. The beginning of any radio show is a mystery.